Well, good afternoon and welcome to Conversations. This is Michael Stone, your host. And it is Tuesday, so we have some very special guests today. I will tell you about them in just a minute, but I want you to know you're listening to KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City. In Truckee, it's 105.1 FM, translator K286AN. And before we get into our show, I just want to tell you a couple community calendar announcements. There's going to be a multimedia presentation about working with refugees on the Burmese border on Wednesday, 7 p.m. It'll be held at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City. For information, call 559-6781. Also, a local photographer and self-described painter of light, Douglas Hooper, will display some of the most recent work in his Nighttime is the Right Time exhibit at Sierra Commons, located in the Stone House in Nevada City on Friday, April 2nd, 4 to 7 p.m. Phone 305-8975 for additional information. And Past Due and Playable will play acoustic swing and bluegrass at the old 5 Mile House above Nevada City on Highway 20 on Wednesday, 6 to 9 p.m. For more information, call 265-8672. I have some really special guests today. The first person I want to introduce you to is a woman that I first heard at Bioneers, and her name is Danielle Drake Burnett. She was previously known as Soul's Journey. She's a writer, spoken word poet, and self-proclaimed culinary artist. Danielle is the founder and executive director of Creation Cocoon for Girls, an Oakland, California-based organization serving girls 8 to 18. Creation Cocoon teaches girls empowerment and self-esteem through the traditional arts, including creative writing, crochet, jewelry making, sewing, bath and body creations, international cooking, and that sort of thing. Her book is wonderful. Cast Iron Life, a collection of poems and recipes, and it's just recently released. Danielle, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you so much, Michael. It is so great to be invited.
Lovely to have you here. And along with Danielle, we have our friend Drew Dillinger, who is a poet, professor, writer, speaker, and he's inspired minds and hearts around the world, performing poetry and keynoting on justice, ecology, cosmology, and compassion. Drew's book of poems, Love Letter to the Milky Way, is in its fourth printing, and he has thousands of devoted readers on five continents. His work has appeared on radio and film and book, anthologies, magazines. He also co-wrote the documentary film The Awakening Universe, which premiered in the United Nations. And he was a key consultant with the Awakening Dreamer program, which we've talked about on this show, Changing the Dream Symposium produced by Pachamama Alliance. He studied cosmology and ecology thought with Thomas Berry for 20 years and is currently finishing his doctoral dissertation on Martin Luther King, Thomas Berry, and the connections between ecology, justice, and cosmology. And Drew joins us from Canada. Welcome, Drew.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be with you.
Great to have you on again. So let's start out, Danielle. One of the things I didn't mention was that you were the Poetry Slam champion in Oakland, and you were fourth in the nation. Now, a lot of people don't know what a Poetry Slam champion is. So can you tell us a little bit about what is Poetry Slam, and how did you get involved in that?
Okay. Poetry Slam actually originated in Chicago. I'm not exactly sure when. I think it was in the late 80s or early 90s. And it is just a very straightforward kind of conversational performance style of poetry. To hear my mother describe it is sort of funny. She says, you know, it's sort of raw. It's kind of in your face a little bit. But she said that she always loved it because of that. And it started that way, I think, because the venues that Slam was born out of were bars, you know, smoky, loud bars. And so you had to be able to, if you were going to say a poem in those types of environment, you had to be able to grab the attention of the audience when they were not always ready to listen to poetry. And so it has kind of evolved. And then there's the spoken word tradition of the beat poets and things like that that it's been influenced by. And so it's just taken on a life of its own. There is a show on HBO called HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam, and they do spoken word and slam style performances, but slam in and of itself is a competition. Usually there's an audience of people. There are four judges picked randomly out of the audience, and they're given scorecards. And using a point system, each poet can get up to 10 points from each judge. So there's a total of 40 points that you could get, and the lowest score is always dropped. And so the final score, the biggest score that you can get, is a 30. In Poetry Slam, you have 3 minutes to say your piece, and you can't use any props. And there's a 10-second grace period, and you just go. And I got into it. I first started doing spoken word here in Oakland in 2001. And then in 2002, I started slamming. And the first year I started slamming, I made it onto the 2002 Poetry Slam scene in Oakland. And then the second year in 2003, when I did it again, I ended up being the Poetry Slam champion in the city of Oakland that year. And then each slam team is formed by four poets and then an alternate, and we go to national competitions and compete against other cities from around the nation. So the year that I was the slam champion in 2003, we placed fourth in the nation out of 63 teams from around the nation.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Very good work. And also to give, Drew, let's just give people a little background. One of the things I'd like you to talk about is tell people about the Poets for Global Justice and the purpose of that, of course, an organization which you founded yourself.
Sure. Poets for Global Justice, well, the idea behind it was to use the arts as a way to promote activism and to get people involved in social change movements and to spread awareness around ecological and social justice issues. You know, the arts have always been an integral part of our social change movement. You think about the role of singing in the civil rights movement, or you think of the role of oratory and preaching and rhetoric from Martin Luther King or other speakers. You know, the arts, rhetoric, poetry, music, dance, drama. You know, in the Bay Area we have the San Francisco Mime Troupe. So there's always been a tradition of the arts as being integral and even essential to our social change movement. So the idea behind Poets for Global Justice was to encourage this type of integration of arts and activism. And so Danielle was one of the poets that was involved in that project. And, you know, we have performed at teach-ins and in the streets. We've performed outside the Chevron World Headquarters in the Bay Area. We've performed in the streets against the war. So it's not a group that's really active right now, but it's a project that I had in the past, and that kind of morphed into the press that I have now, which is a small independent press that's publishing work that promotes a vision of ecology and conscious transformation and social change. And so I was just very thrilled when Danielle asked me to publish her book, and she's such a talent that it was really exciting to be able to publish Cast Iron Life, a collection of poems and recipes on Planetize the Movement Press. But that's really always been my vision, was to use the arts. I actually started as a rapper, even though that might sound funny, but to use the arts, to use poetry as a way to build bridges between people and to help contribute in some small way to the planetary movement that is growing to create a world based on ecology and social justice.
That's great. I definitely want to get into Cast Iron Life and some of your poetry in a minute, but I'd like to set a little background. We just had Amy Goodman on before our show, and a group that I've been involved with for quite a while, the Southern Poverty Law group, mm-hmm. was part of it, and they're reporting on the increase in hate crimes and in hate groups and patriot groups, so-called patriot groups or right-wing militias, and there's been an increase in just the last year of 244%. And Danielle, your poetry really speaks to a world that many of us don't know, a world that, you know, as I think Drew or someone said, we don't even drive down the streets of some of the places you talk about. Some of our listeners don't have that experience, and your poetry is so powerful. I read my girlfriend one of your poems last night, the Wake the Dead poem, and it was very disturbing, and yet I had a visceral experience of what you were talking about with the power of your poetry. Can you give us a little background about where you're coming from, and then maybe we could do one of these poems, maybe that one or another one, that speaks to this kind of hidden area, particularly in the black and people of color communities that are the impoverished communities in our country here?
Sure. I mean, that is sort of a big question. But
it's very big. It's very big. Just give us I get carried away because I got so much out of your poetry that I want to pull that out for people to appreciate the depth of it and feel there's such a need now for us to understand and have compassion and kindness towards one another, and it's the opposite. The reason I talked about the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, was that this rise in anger and people being accosted and congressmen and senators that aren't voting the way that people want them, getting attacked both physically and brutally, verbally too. So I'm trying to get you to kind of lay out some background there for how that's happening and how you see it, the rise of that from your perspective, the anger.
Absolutely. I would say that the anger really comes from a position of not understanding, not knowing, and not having to have understood. Just in terms of my background, I'm from Southern California. I'm from South Central Los Angeles. And historically, that has been a very low-income area, riddled with gang violence, and plagued with just a lot of drug trafficking and things like that. My parents are from the South. My mom is from Texas, and my dad is from Mississippi. And
this is where all these recipes come from, huh?
Absolutely.
We'll talk about those too.
But they came during the wave the influx of Southern blacks into California during World War II, and they came because they were trying to escape the Jim Crow laws of the 30s and 40s and 50s and all of that, and why, you know, people were in the whole culture of segregation, and they came trying to escape that because it is devastating. It is terrifying to live in a place where you don't have any control over yourself, your family, and that everything that you do is controlled by the whims of other people. And so they were trying to escape that. And so there were droves of people coming to California during World War II because of the jobs that were available at the ports and things like that. So I am a product of all of those kinds of people coming to California to hopefully raise their children in a different kind of way. But again, you know, you come to a different place and expect things to be different. And then when they're not, that's when people get upset. There's a poem that is in the book as well called Truth. And Truth is really the story of how gangs got started in L.A., but it also references how the government was integral in, particularly the CIA, was integral in pushing crack into low-income neighborhoods in Los Angeles, and how it just really escalated into like a full-on gang and drug war in the 80s when I was growing up there.
Can you do that poem for us, Danielle?
Sure.
I'd love to have you do it.
I have my book here, and I'm going to turn to the page just right now. Okay. So it's called Truth. They called for a truth. After all the fighting, crimson and indigo bandana waving, retaliation from trunks and back seats, frigid steel and scorching blood on Los Angeles freeways and neighborhood streets. A young girl from the West Side, innocent yet aware that the men packing rifles and Uzis into that trunk on a Sunday evening were not doing this for show. This was before colors and boys in the hood. This was dropping off a cousin at home after church and dinner at Aunt Yvonne's house, after watching the new Michael Jackson video, playing with Barbie dolls and dyeing hair with Kool-Aid. In the beginning, they didn't need a truce, just a welcome mat, a smile toward travel-worn faces, weary from train rides across the Mason-Dixon line. Folks from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, settling into Watts, piecing together homes south of Central Avenue bordered by Manchester with an odd sister, brother, cousin, or friend from the old red dirt town. Their arrival was met instead with lips set tight, teeth rigid, and resentment seething from alabaster residents at the sienna dust and ashy legs, balancing hopeful hearts, settling around them while the world battled in a second war. Feeling separated, longing for home, they came together in churches over special company dinners of fried chicken, pintos, and greens, house parties where the blues slipped into conversations of new lives and how things ain't changed, and in the back rooms and garages where liquor dripped down throats allowed breath to speak of hate and necessary protection against it. Here leaders emerged, marshaled brown armies, baby steps of political organizations, then protective means against violence, white hot and searing. Resentment hissed, spit, and bubbled over into 1940s, 50s, 60s streets, exploded into rebellion in Watts. Young couple, eyes wide, navigated by rumors of better schools and a better life, tired of fighting Jim Crow, of fighting to survive, and all we ever wanted was a piece of just dessert, a freedom pie. Now he fights in the streets, policing the police, trying to make a safe life for children and wife. Agitated, fire setters and stone hurlers of the rebellion in Watts wanted change. We're not content with passive-aggressive division found beating against Pacific shores. Created organized parties of black denim and leather, peppered terms of endearment, comrade, and revolution into hungry ears, demanded balance on weighted streets by any means necessary. FBI and LAPD tagged these fresh expressions of self-worth and deserving equality radical, a threat to national security, used their best tactics to separate and overpower. Counterintelligence, COINTELPRO, made strong foundations weak, sent leaders to death row. By 1972, a community once balmy with skin tone affection turned desolate. Youth now windblown tumbleweeds. Progressive organizations gone. Black leaders gone. Direction gone. Raymond Washington, young boy reminiscing. It can't go down like this. I remember when we had our community on lock. Now we victims to squad cars just walking down our block. So actions repeat as black boys don black leather, form semi-political organizations, recreate Panther's militant style, minus principle, called his new crew Baby Avenues, a.k.a. Avenue Cribs. Tides turned as Cribs added pierced earlobes and canes to their new ensemble. Crippled walk now branded crime activities. unemployed youth began jacking peers for leather jackets. Crippin' has a new definition, thieving, murdering, and jacking. L.A. Brims and Piru Street Boys, non-Crip associated, indignant at the slow extinction of their crews, held a meeting on Piru Street in Compton, chose red as the color they waved while avenging the deaths of their slain brothers. 1985, a young boy at the crossroads. His block is what he knows, and what he knows is that he will have to make a decision, line dividing blue and red, and they are making it hard to be a lighthearted black boy free from violence, Jim Crow or gang-induced. And he will either be Crip or Blood, and he does this to survive, and he sells crack to change his life, and they tell him he will have to end lives because they are moving in on his territory and they must die. A city of angels scooping up bodies, their winged army increasing with young cherub faces, while the CIA pushes crack into neighborhoods. Poverty pushes desperation into homes. Gangs push crack into streets. Streets push crack into bodies. Bodies fall, blood spills, bones break, colors wave, fingers form signs, and now they need a truth because it's all they can do to survive.
Whew. Wow. Thank you.
It is heavy.
That's intense.
But
it's heavy
real.
And it's intense, but it's the real world. And this is a world a lot of us have no contact with or no even imagination of what it's like. I want to really plug your book here, Cast Iron Life, A Collection of Poems and Recipes. One more question. How did the recipes get in here? Just to kind of lighten up some of the heaviness?
You know,
some great recipes.
I wanted this book to be representative of my life, the life of my family, the life of my community. One of the things that has always made us strong in the African American community, even through a lot of this violence that happens, is the ability to come together as a community and for a moment step away from the ills that are constantly plaguing the society. And we do that a lot of times through just good old Southern cooking, you know, coming together over meals. And that's something that I really tried to create in my life with my husband and my friends and family. And Drew knows, he's been over to our house.
I was going to say, I hope you've been feeding Drew here.
and Drew is from the South, and so he's very aware of that Southern culture really coming together around food. And so I wanted it to be representative not just of the pain but the joys that we experience in our communities too. And I love to cook. I love to entertain and share of my heart and my spirit through the food that I create. So there's a lot of love in this book.
There is indeed. And, you know, he's getting awful skinny. I think you better invite him over while he's working on his dissertation here.
You got to feed him. I know he likes to.
Speaking of your dissertation, Drew, you know, I'm wondering how it's going. You're pulling together Thomas Berry and Martin Luther King and looking at peace, justice, and ecology and the bridge between those two. Can you talk a little bit about what you're up to in that area?
Sure, you bet. Well, you know, as you know, I studied with Thomas Berry for 20 years. He was my mentor. And
you're a lucky guy.
Thank you. Yeah, it was an incredible blessing. For those who don't know, Thomas Berry is an ecological writer, a cosmological thinker. You know, cosmology is not a term that's familiar to a lot of people, but it means the study of the universe or the story that a culture tells itself about how the world came to be and how we fit into it. So we have scientific cosmology in recent centuries, but we also have the traditional cosmologies or worldviews, so Buddhist cosmology, Hindu cosmology, Jewish cosmology, Christian cosmology. And we also have the cosmologies, of course, of indigenous cultures around the world. So Thomas Berry was really looking at what is the worldview that has led us to the ecological crisis. If we want to understand the dynamics that have brought Western civilization to the brink of ecological collapse, we have to look for the origins of those dynamics in our worldview, in our cosmology, in our fundamental story that we tell ourselves about what is reality, how did the world get here, how do we treat nature, how do we treat each other. And so as I studied Thomas Berry, you know, as Daniel said, I am from the South, and I was always deeply interested in issues of racial justice and racial healing. And so I've kind of been a lifelong admirer and student of the civil rights movement, and really impressed and amazed by the ordinary people who did extraordinary things to fundamentally transform our country during the 50s and 60s. And, you know, and Martin Luther King is just one of those extraordinary people. And so as I read Thomas Berry and as I read Martin Luther King, I began to notice certain similar themes. I'll give you just one quick example, but Thomas Berry would say, you know, we shouldn't treat any being as a thing, as an object to be exploited. He would say, you know, the universe is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects, you know, rather than feeling that we're an I and other people or other beings are an it. We need to recognize that every being is a subject. Every being has a kind of a divine personhood. So Berry would say, the universe is a communion of subjects. It's composed of subjects to be communed with rather than objects to be exploited. And then on the other hand, on the social justice side, I would look at Martin Luther King, and he would use a word like thingify. He would say, we thingify people. The problem, the reason why slavery, segregation, white supremacy, discrimination is so immoral and unethical is because we're treating sacred realities, people in this case, as objects to be exploited. And Dr. King said, a nation that will hold people in slavery for 244 years will thingify them, will treat them as things. So I began to say, wow, Berry is talking about treating sacred realities as objects to be exploited in an ecological, cosmological context. And Dr. King is talking about treating people, you know, sacred beings that are humans, as things, thingifying them. And I said, there's a common principle here that's flowing through ecology and social justice. And that, you know, that common principle is what I would call personhood or sacred personhood. Of course, every human deserves to be treated as a sacred reality that's worthy of compassion, dignity, and respect. But in an ecological or cosmological context, really every being should be treated with reverence or respect. Every animal, every species, every ecosystem, and the planet as a whole should be treated with reverence and respect. So this idea of personhood, that every being deserves to be treated with reverence and respect, is a common principle that I see connecting ecology, social justice, and cosmology. So what I say basically is that we need to build a movement or strengthen the already existing movements to connect ecology, social justice, and cosmology. And we need to bring in cosmology because the worldview, the story, is so important. But we need to build this movement that bridges ecology and social justice based around common values such as personhood, reverence, and community, you know, that we're all part of a one single sacred community, whether it's a human community or the entire earth community. There's a common principles that I see as flowing through ecology and social justice and cosmology.
Beautiful. That reminds me of your poem, Hymn to the Sacred Body of the Universe. Would you do that for us today?
You bet. I'd be happy to.
Thanks.
Hymn to the Sacred Body of the Universe. Let's meet at the confluence where you flow into me and one breath swirls between our lungs. Let's meet at the confluence where you flow into me and one breath swirls between our lungs. For one instant to dwell in the presence of the galaxies. For one instant to live in the truth of the heart. The poet says this entire traveling cosmos is the secret one, slowly growing a body. Two eagles are mating, clasping each other's claws and turning cartwheels in the sky. Grasses are blooming, grandfathers dying, consciousness blinking on and off. All of this is happening at once. All of this vibrating into existence out of nothingness. Every particle foaming into existence, transcribing the ineffable. Every particle foaming into existence, transcribing the ineffable. Arising and passing away. Arising and passing away. 23 trillion times per second. When Buddha saw that, he smiled. 16 million tons of rain are falling every second on the planet. An ocean perpetually falling, and every drop is your body. Every motion, every feather, every thought is your body. Time is your body. And the infinite, curled inside like invisible rainbows folded into light. Every word of every tongue is love telling a story to her own ears. Every word of every tongue is love telling a story to her own ears. Let our lives be incense, burning like a hymn to the sacred body of the universe. My religion is rain. My religion is stone. My religion reveals itself to me in sweaty epiphany. Every leaf, every river, every animal, your body, every creature trapped in the gears of corporate nightmares, every species made extinct was once your body. 10 million people are dreaming that they're flying. Junipers and violets are blossoming, stars exploding and being born. God is having deja vu. I am one elaborate crush. We cry petals as the void is singing. You are the dark that holds the stars in intimate distance that spun the whirling world into existence. Let's meet at the confluence where you flow into me and one breath swirl between our lungs.
It's a prayer. It's not only a poem, it's a beautiful prayer. I always love that one. Thank you, Drew. I want to tell people that you can get Drew's book, Love Letter to the Milky Way, a book of poems, and also a wonderful CD, which I just happened to hear for the first time, which is about poetry, cosmology, and justice, An Evening with Drew Dillinger. And Drew, how do they do that? Are you still Poets for Global Justice, or do you have a new website?
No, I've got a new website. I mean, that will actually point you to the website, but the main one that I'm using now is www.drewdellinger.com. So that's DREWDELLINGER. So drewdellinger.org. Or you can always call me at 1-866-POETICS, which is 1-866-763-8427. That's 1-866-763-8427. Or just check me out on the web at drewdellinger.org.
That's great. Thank you. I want to get back, Danielle, to some of the work you're doing, and I'm particularly interested in finding out not just what you're doing, but finding out about the girls. You were the founder and executive director of Creation Cocoon for Girls in Oakland. It's a community-based organization, and you're serving girls from 8 to 18. Tell us about your girls and how the program is impacting their lives.
Well, I started Creation Cocoon because I felt that I had such an amazing upbringing, just a lot of love and time and energy put into me by the women in my life, my grandmother, my mother, my aunts. They all were rooted in the arts, traditional arts. They all sewed and did crochet. My mother is a quilter. She is preserving and reviving the African-American tradition of quilting, and was just written up in Pasadena, California, down south where we're from, about her work with quilts. And so I just have all of this amazing, rich tradition through the arts, and I wanted to share it with the community in a way that taught self-esteem, because that is how I learned how to love myself, how I learned how to value myself, and where I come from. And so I started this organization, and we started off at Ile Omide School, which is an African-centered school in East Oakland. And then I started hooking up with different after school programs. One of them was at Lincoln School in Oakland, and that school is really interesting because most of the students there are first generation immigrants from China. And you think, wow, how can I work with first generation immigrant girls from China? But they really, really took to the program, and it became one of their premier after school projects for the girls to do. They really loved it. I also worked with Lighthouse Charter School, which has a predominantly Latin American population. So a lot of the children are from Mexico and other regions south of there. And so it has really turned into be this program that not only teaches self-empowerment for girls, but also teaches diversity through the arts. And that's something that I was hoping, but I wasn't expecting that would come through so clearly.
That's beautiful. I love the way you've put those groups together. You don't usually see that, and you know, it's that's an amazing thing. I want to tell people about your book also, Cast Iron Life. You know, it's got all this great and very powerful poetry in it, but it's also got some amazing recipes in here. You know, beef, chicken, and prawn stir fry, and chicken wings, and enchiladas, and all these different recipes. There's some great things in here. My mouth is watering looking at your book. And how do they get a hold of this book now?
They can go to castironlife.com. That's www.castironlife.com. Or they can go to Drew's website, because there's also a link there. So either one of those two is just fine. Yeah.
Great. Drew, there's a new term you're using that I hadn't heard until recently, and that's planetizing the movement. Where did it come from? What does it mean? And what are you doing?
Sure. Well, planetize the movement is a phrase that I borrowed from Martin Luther King. Toward the end of his life, in his most prophetic and fiery and radical period, which interestingly enough is a period that American history seems to often paper over or forget. But in the last 5 years of his life, Dr. King was really linking the issues of racism to the issue of war and militarism and to the issue of economic inequality. So really, you know, we think of King as focusing primarily on racism, but he was just as concerned about war and poverty. And so he was really seeing the connections between these various social justice issues. And he was also wanting to link the civil rights movement in the United States with struggles around the world. So he would often, the last day he was alive, in fact, he told his associate, Bernard Lafayette, he said, "It's clear to me that the next step is to internationalize the civil rights movement and to take it international." And he wanted to see if nonviolent direct action could be applied in different contexts, in different situations, in different struggles around the globe. And there's one reference in one of his late speeches where he said, "We haven't even begun to build the skills and the strategy necessary to truly planetize our movement for social justice." And when I heard those three words, planetize our movement, I was like, that is it. That really describes exactly where we are now. If you know Paul Hawkins' work, he's talking about the largest planetary movement in history is unfolding right now as millions, perhaps a million or 2 million organizations all over the globe are working for ecology, social justice, freedom, compassion, democracy, respect, and dignity. And yet it's a movement that hasn't even recognized itself. So planetize the movement is a phrase that I borrow from Dr. King to describe this new global movement that's happening on every continent. And I also use it to convey the coming together of ecology and social justice struggles. So I talk about the need to planetize the movement in the spirit of Dr. King and in reference to the movements that are already happening, but we need to strengthen. You know, there's inspiring movements all over the globe, and yet we're still headed for ecological collapse. There's resistance and visionary activism and creative transformation of culture and consciousness, and yet we're still on the verge of economic chaos. So we have a lot of work to do, and yet there's inspiring things that are already happening. So I think we need to recognize the movement of movements that's happening and strengthen that. And that's, you know, a bit of what I mean when I use that phrase, planetize the movement.
Yeah, it's amazing. You and I, of course, were there when Paul first said there's 100,000 groups, you know, and each one contains so many people, and it's flying under the radar. And then it was 1 million, and now with the research going on, it's 2 million. And sometimes those of us working on some of these issues feel pretty alone, and yet I think it's really important to realize that this is a planetary movement. I'm leaving in a couple weeks to go down to Bolivia for the first People's Conference on Climate Change and Mother Earth Rights. And there are people just flooding into Cochabamba from all parts of the world and all these different organizations. So there's a sign for hope. And I was just thinking about an article. I actually put it out in my newsletter that I found from our friend Van Jones, who was talking about moving on, but, you know, kind of what happened with his leaving the White House. And I was so touched by how much deeper the man's love, and he called Glenn Beck and other people, that he was under friendly fire. And talking about the things that we want. And one of the things that I think is really important for all of us looking at peace, justice, and ecology issues is not to separate and not to marginalize and or separate ourselves, alienate ourselves from other people, but to focus on the things that we want and not be so loud in our criticism of what we don't have, but keep our focus there. And Danielle, I think a lot of the work you're doing, really, in spite of the fact you have some really powerful poetry, you're exposing what's happening. But tell us about your vision. You know, when I see you working with the girls and the things you're doing, you must have a pretty big vision there, girl. Tell us about it.
I do, and the vision just really speaks to there's a line in one of the poems that I wrote, and it says that my purpose is to connect hearts and minds and make you feel something, and that there's this need for me to develop some sort of illumination and understanding, and that I think is the piece that transcends the work that I do, the work that Drew does, the work that we're all doing together, is that understanding and really seeing each other as people, not as things. Understanding that our experiences are all connected is what is driving my passion, and that we cannot move forward until we start to be able to see every single thing as being important, every single thing. And I really liked what Drew said, every single thing is having an eye, that divine part of us that is connected to a higher source that that connects us all. That for me is what drives my passion, and it is the solution. It's the solution for what's happening in Oakland and New Orleans and Detroit and Baltimore, and it's the solution that needs to happen for the global movement of ecology. It's what needs to happen for the indigenous cultures that are on the brink of extinction. It's what needs to happen for all of us. The more that we understand about each other, the more we're able to really get on board and try to celebrate, not just save, but to celebrate each other and this world vision.
And what I love also about your poetry, it isn't just celebrating the other, it's starting with celebrating ourselves.
Oh, absolutely.
You have a poem, What You Didn't Expect, that kind of speaks to that. You want to do that one?
Sure.
Okay.
It's always interesting to me to see
what things people choose.
Yeah.
Well, you can choose anything you like. I just made me think of that because I was thinking, you know, these girls that you're working with, you're starting with self-esteem. You're starting with just being who they are and learning the things that they're good at and the things that they don't want to do. And then that flowers into something so much bigger. And that's why I was thinking of that poem.
Yeah. What You Didn't Expect is actually a poem that I wrote about my husband.
Uh-huh.
And how by opening myself up to love that I was able to get some of the things that I didn't even know that I wanted. And so I'm not sure if you still want to hear.
I don't know that it. You know, I just remembered part of it. I was just grabbing one. But anyone you'd like to do? We're running short on time, and I also remembered that wasn't one of the. Some of them are fairly long.
Yeah,
and
fairly long.
I was looking for one that spoke to that kind of relationship to ourself, relationship to other. And, you know, so if you have one in particular you'd like to do, but, you know, it's nice to celebrate your husband, too. I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
It's always nice to do that. And I think that there is one called Prison Walls that I want to read.
That's great.
And I think that this speaks to that ability to really just take some time with yourself and ask yourself the hard questions. Because by doing that, you open yourself up to your real purpose. And that's what I did in creating Cast Iron Life. And it was the beginning of me learning how to love myself so that I could then love other people and really create community.
That's great, because that's one of the ones I marked, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Fabulous.
Prison Walls. The walls of this room hold me captive as its prisoner, sentenced to 3 years solitary confinement, chained fingers to pen, mind to ether, force feed change and growth like bread and water. Inside these walls the air is heavy, rings tears from drywall and paint, filled with remembrance of tongues formed of dagger and ego-imbued intentions. These walls claim ignorance as its outlaw, and this is real. This is mental detox, thought rehab, emotional boot camp. This is leaving 20-something paper dolls float away on slicing breezes, accepting responsibility and no one to blame. This is sobering lines of truth, wisdom manifest, releasing chain and lock, unleashing revolution.
May we all release that chain and lock. That's beautiful. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you.
Well, we're getting close to the end, and Drew, I'd like to have you speak to our listeners. One of my questions is, how is poetry important to peace, justice, and ecology, and how does that relate to the story you were talking about that Thomas Berry talks about?
Yeah, you bet. Well, you spoke earlier about some of the vigilantism, and you know, in the wake of the passage of the health insurance reform bill, we've seen windows at Democratic Party headquarters being smashed by bricks. And I think one of the lessons of that is the power of the word. When we have reckless people like Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin, you know, telling people that this is the end of America as we know it. You know, those words have repercussions. But so that's kind of a negative example of the power of the word. But if you think of the oratory of Martin Luther King, if you think of the vision of the feminist movement and remember that the personal is political, or you think of the art that really stirs us from someone like Bob Dylan or Bob Marley, you know, the word can be used, of course, in very positive, transforming, and inspiring ways. And what you were talking about is so important, that we need to heal some of the divisions in our world and come from a place of love and compassion and inclusiveness, and recognize that the people who are lashing out right now are people who are afraid. And we need to hold each other in love. And, you know, if you think about that, we have in the United States something like 20% unemployment. In real terms, I mean, the numbers may say 9 or 10%, but we know that the numbers are always lower than the actuality. So, of course, there's going to be a lot of fear and anxiety in a situation with such economic instability. And you know, to imagine 20% of Americans unemployed in real terms, it becomes even more important that we use our vision, that we use our imagination, you know, that we use our creativity. Humans are very resilient and incredibly creative, and we can really come together in powerful ways when we set our hearts and minds to it. So I think art has, and poetry and speaking and the visual arts and all of the power of the arts, have an important role to play, because it's about imagination. It's about envisioning the kind of world we want to live in, a world where everyone sees each other as part of the same human community, a world where we see the entire planet as a single sacred earth community. And I think the arts can really help us do that. So to me, it's the process of social change and the process of art are both rooted in vision and imagination and transformation.
That's great. That's well said. Beautifully said. A lot of people don't realize that you have a background as a rapper. Is that what you would call yourself? A rapper in the old days? Or
in the old days, I was
a rapper. Yeah.
A rapper and lyricist.
There's a poem that I love that belies that and shows that. And that's The Total Thrust is Global Justice. Could you, you know, kind of begin to wrap us up here with that poem?
You bet. The total thrust is global justice, so we gotta fix the politics and put a check upon its economics, or before you know it, a warrior poet may try to upend the corporate agenda that's got them blind to the real bottom line. It's intense when you sense the only interests on the docket are fat cats with Republicrats in their pocket. It's crooked now, just look at how the pundits are funded. They're devious at CBS, and yes, they'll choose the news that fits the script unless I play tricks on the matrix. In case you can't guess it, I'm not to be messed with. The folks know my art form, come straight from the heart form, a lyrical storm that departs from the norm and transforms as I'm given rhymes for the minds in the times that we live in. I can't hang with the anguish, and I don't want my language to languish, because there ain't nothing like Drew's hip-hop haikus. I got a mandate to disturb the urban landscape. We got tyrannies right here in these states, and you never know when they'll go right back to some tactics like COINTELPRO. If we could see through the lies to see how they brutalize and get cops to beat speech in the streets and guard sweatshops, I'm ending these industries. Please, can we factor the effect of the trajectory? This whole place is racist and sexist, from North Dakota down to Texas, with the 21st century's youth in penitentiaries. And the night never seemed this dark, but now half of the stars are behind prison bars. Oh, say, can you see? But if we can dream a new day, it may be. You had to know the baddest bro with the fattest flow would shake up the status quo with my adjectives and adverbs and ad-libs. And like Gandhi, protest is my modus operandi. It's like Malcolm and Martin's evolution with art and revolution, because the total thrust is global justice.
Yeah, I was sitting here playing my conga drum while you were doing it.
Nice.
Well, we're running out of time, I'm afraid. Danielle, tell us what you'd like us to know about your work, something that, you know, if you had one thing you could really tell people that you wanted them to know, what is that?
I would say that if we come from a position of love and understanding and really work within ourselves to exercise whatever is in us that makes us afraid to step out and see other people from exactly where they are and to see our connectedness, then that is when we will truly be able to achieve this idea of social justice and ecological justice. It's really important, and it is a self movement before it is a community movement.
That's beautiful. Well, I just want to thank you both, Drew Dillinger, for your tireless work and your support of people like Danielle, and you're on the road now. And again, the website for them to go to?
DrewDellinger.org, www.DrewDellinger.org.
And that's D-E-L-L-I-N-G-E-R. And also, Danielle Drake Burnett, thank you so much. It's just been inspiring. And again, your website so people can find Cast Iron Life, or they can go to Drew's, I know.
Right. It is castironlife.com.
Great. So, and also planetizethemovement.org. Thank you both so much. It's just been a joy being with you. I hope to see you at Bioneers this year.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. I'll be there. Thanks, Michael.
Look forward to it. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, there we go. What a great pair. It's nice to have a little poetry to kind of make an interlude in some of the things that we're doing here. So it's about time to go out. I want to tell you what's coming up. Tom Myers is next with So Many Roads. Elisa Parker, Music Magazine, KVMR Evening News at 5:50, 6 o'clock, KVMR On-Air Auction, 9 o'clock, The Other Side with Mikhail Graham. And at 10 o'clock, The Funk Hole, that's coming up next. Now, I'm going to be traveling pretty much all month, but we've got some great shows coming up for you. And next week will be David White, who's also going to be here on the 17th. And you can find out more about that almost anywhere. On the 13th, Tim Wagner and Kathy Fish, we're going to be talking about the Living Lands Agrarian Network and getting your garden started. James O'D, Creative Stress. Amazing interview and wonderful man. And then Velcro Ripper at the end of the month. I'll be coming back May 4th from Bolivia with an interview with Sandra Ingerman, amazing shamanic healer, talking about medicine for the earth. So thanks for listening, and we'll be having our shows regularly. They're just going to be pre-recorded, so hope you'll stay tuned in. And stay tuned for Tom Myers for a rock and blues show coming up.